Welcome, I'm Richard Lang, and I am speaking today to my friend Sam Blight. I'm in London. Sam is in Western Australia, and I've known Sam for nearly 20 years, I think. We met in a workshop, and we have enjoyed sharing our true nature together over that time. And Sam and his wife Mary are just fantastic helps in terms of running the website, publishing, translating. They've just been a fantastic team. So it's with great pleasure that I'm just going to spend the next period of time chatting with Sam, and he can give you a little bit of background. What we thought we would start off on is the relationship between seeing who you really are, the headless way, and authority, something like that, and then we'll see where it goes. So, welcome, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
And just to introduce yourself a little bit, I mean, particularly in terms of why this subject is so interesting to you.
Sure. Well, I've been interested in meditation and trying to find out what the hell's going on, basically, from a fairly young age. And I discovered what I'll call conscious first personhood, or seeing through the headless way, due to you, of course. You were there when it happened, a long time ago now, and it's really been a game changer. I've gone from being a seeker to a finder, and the end of that search really frees up a lot of resources. And by that I mean, when you see who you really are as a direct experience, and can begin to get the hang of living from there, it's a completely different approach to life, and things take on different meanings, and you get interested in different things. And you start to examine, I guess, in my case anyway, I started to examine the path I took to get here, and the long and winding road. And for me, that involved a number of stages, I guess. The first was my introduction to psychedelic drugs, which really alerted me to the dimension of the inner dimension, I guess you'd have to say, the depth dimension, as Bishop Spong calls it. The idea that there's more to life than the surface, or our thoughts about that, or our feelings about that, or that there's this kind of hidden realm, which is hinted at in a lot of the spiritual and psychological literature. And I got and it presented it to me in such a way as it showed me that in undeniably. And then gave me a glimpse of it anyway. And I had to figure out what to do about that in terms of the rest of my life. And I guess from that time on, although I've had a career in doing various things and lived my life, that's been the kind of leitmotif of my existence, is trying to come to terms with what I discovered on those early adventures. And
So
that took me.
you had a experience of depth, and did you that stayed with you really?
Well, the experience itself was, you'd almost call fleeting, although it was, and it wasn't just one. I explored it with drugs for about a year, I guess, and also read as widely as I could at the time. It was the 70s, other people's accounts of what they thought it meant, and that included people like Aldous Huxley, Timothy Leary, Hoffman, the guy who invented LSD, and then later on, I read other people who had different interpretations of this. But the one thing they had in common, and the one thing that seemed to be valued about this, was the mystical experience, the experience of, I guess you'd call it, the falling away of separation between self and the world, the sensation of oceanic boundlessness. That experience was what haunted me. And because I experienced it as not only being real, but actually in some senses being more real, or at least my life was not as real when I wasn't experiencing that. Or in touch with that in some way. And so I went on a long journey of seeking to kind of figure out what that was about. Now, this was not a religious search in my way of, my approach was not at all. I didn't come from a religious background. So it was more a scientific. I was a kind of psychonaut. I really wanted to find out what's going on. And the sort of scientific background I came from didn't really have much to say about this. And what it did have to say was pretty unhelpful to a large extent, because it was all dealing with what you could say about the brain from the outside. And there's definitely, you know, correlates in the brain when you have these experiences, but they don't explain the first person experience of this and its importance and its significance. So that led me into Buddhism first. Well, first of all, I dropped out of university without completing a degree. It was fatal to my education in that sense, because I just couldn't see any point in doing anything, you know, committing myself to anything major until I sorted this out, you know, because it's a fairly important question. What am I exactly? What is this life? You know? And for me, it wasn't just an academic question. It really did get into my marrow. So I did had some experience of Buddhist meditation. I did some Vipassana courses, which I found helpful. Mindfulness. I understood the idea of being present to the moment, you know, and not being lost in thought, how important that was. And that was helpful in many respects. It was helpful in other ways in my life. It helped me certainly. It's a very good way of training your attention, you know, for life generally. But it didn't really answer my questions. I had some fleeting experiences of expansion, but they kind of was like kinds of things that I experienced on LSD. They would come and go. So then I got involved in a cult, as you do. I was kind of recruited by a psychotherapist that I'd been visiting, because he had been advertised to me as someone who understood these states and would be able to guide me, because I really did need a kind of mentor at that. It was in my very early 20s. And I needed someone to, an older person, just to tell me what the hell was going on. And his advice was, at the beginning, pretty good. He said, look, what you've seen on those experiences is real, but you need to find out how to access them without the drugs, because that's not a long-term solution. I kind of figured that out for myself, but it was great to hear it confirmed, particularly these experiences are real bit. You know, it's great. It's like we often find in the social aspect of seeing, it's great to have people who take what your experiences as a first person seriously, and don't just say, oh, you're tripping. But unfortunately, he was captured by a cult and he pulled me into it, which was not his fault. I mean, it was the Rajneesh cult, which at the time in the late it was the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, was pulling a lot of people in from around the world, very bright people too. I mean, who saw it, Rajneesh's approach as being a kind of a synthesis of East and West, you know, the best of human development and Eastern wisdom and so on. And to my untrained eye, it looked pretty good too. It helped, I guess, that at the time, I found out later, he was plagiarizing Alan Watts to a great extent, which is a great guy to plagiarize, let's face it. not word for word, but a lot. What he was saying when I sort of encountered him was basically had a lot of Watts in it and made a lot of sense to me. And the other thing that I'd been groomed to believe was that and this was partly because I'd been around the Theosophical Society and Eastern religious approaches, that you needed a master. You needed an enlightened master in order to help you through, you know, to liberation, and that you couldn't do it by yourself. So we were kind of searching for a master, the psychologist and a small band of seekers around him. And we came across Rajneesh, and he basically said, this is the guy. He went and saw him in India, phoned me back in Australia and said, yeah, you've got to come. This guy's the real deal. So on that basis, I got involved. And I spent about 10 years in the cult, had lots of amazing experiences. And at a certain point, I realized that all was not well in the Garden of Eden. I mean, no one joins a cult as a perspicacious ex-Scientologist, I can't remember the name to my shame, pointed out that you can't, nobody joins a cult. They join a movement or they join a band of fellow people with similar ideas or, you know, kindred spirits who are going to change the world, change themselves. It's all going to be wonderful. And that's pretty much what I signed up for. But of course.
And what was wrong with it? What did you. What wasn't all, you know, wasn't well in the state of Denmark?
Well, there were a couple of, the thing is you, it's all there at the beginning. It's like it's hidden in plain sight, but you tend to see, a man sees what he wants to see and disregards the rest. There was a sign at the entrance to the meditation hall, to the lecture hall. We used to go and listen to him speak. It said, leave your shoes and your mind at the door. So as there was this idea from the very get-go that your mind was a problem, that your own critical faculties were a barrier to your enlightenment, and that your way was to surrender completely to this higher understanding and let this come into you, and that would do the trick. That your doubts, misgivings, any resistance you had to this process was actually your ego, your problem, and had to be viewed in that way and gotten rid of or worked around in some way. So that was one thing that increasingly I found, not immediately, but it began to bother me. Like, I began to notice that people who did very well at what they were doing in the ashram got demoted and ended up in the garbage department. There was a troupe of players that we did Shakespeare. A lot of very talented people ended up in this cult, I can tell you. Some brilliant people. And there was a bunch of people from Royal Shakespeare who were there, and they trained a bunch of players who did various plays, Midsummer's Night's Dream, in Shakespeare. And as part of the ashram outreach, they sort of sent these out into India and did these concerts as part of our PR, you know. And they were brilliant. They were very good. But as they got more famous, the guru started to bag them more and more. Said that they, you know, and anybody who stood up to got too started to flourish a bit too much, got banged down again. He said, "Oh, they're
competition."
Yeah. He said, "Only enlightened people are truly creative." So he had this category of enlightenment, right? And he was in it, and we weren't. And however good we were at what we did, or you know, that we weren't there. At one point, he was interviewed going into America. I know at one of the interviews he did after the ranch collapsed, he was talking about how he was just surrounded by his friends and we're all equal here and blah, blah, blah. And a journalist asked him, then why are you sitting up on the podium and everyone's sitting around you? And he said, because I have attained. So, so you had this kind of... And there was also a stratification inside the organization, people who were close to him, and right. And there were like rings of influence, and I never got very far up the greasy pole, I got to tell you, but friends of mine did and lived to regret it. One of whom I knew from very early, in fact, before we joined the cult, she's a friend of mine in the hippie community in Perth. She ended up writing a book named Jane Stork, called Breaking the Spell. She actually ended up in the higher echelons of the kind of power elite in the cult, and then became very disillusioned and wrote a kind of tell-all, which is good to read, actually. It helped wake a lot of us up, I think. But suffice it to say, at a certain point, and there's no particular moment I can put my finger on, I realized that it was all a bit dodgy. And I had to ask myself, well, what I've just put 10 years or so of my life into this, what have I got out of it? And it wasn't that much. You know, it was, I mean, I'd realized that that meditation was good, but I kind of knew that before. But I'd actually been applying meditation in my life throughout that. And I guess being in the cult kind of helped that, but that was about it. And I began to look more and more at what had happened and to try and understand it. And this has been an ongoing process. And it's left me with an interest in authoritarianism and cults and the way that people, we're vulnerable to them and the way that they are really built into the structure of our society in a way. I mean, we're it's built into the word culture. Most of our culture comes from cults. So they're not completely bad. It's just that there's an aspect of them which is very dangerous, and I think it's particularly dangerous in our time, and that's authoritarianism. But the thing that really woke me up was meeting you and discovering headlessness and seeing what it meant not to be vulnerable to authoritarianism. In other words, to really respect your own authority with respect to your true nature and not be shaken by anyone else's view. And what anybody else said, or anyone else, how anybody else regarded you, really. It's got nothing to do with that. It's either true where you are and who you are, or it's not. And that's it. Mm. End of story. And that's a tremendous liberation. I mean, it's not the end of the work we've got to do, but it's certainly a very good place to work from, because you're not constantly being distracted by, bad information.
And the experiments all appeal to your experience of yourself and are not
precisely
telling you. They're asking you to look for yourself and be your own authority. That is radical.
This is the application of the scientific attitude to self-inquiry in a very pure way. And science is inherently non-authoritarian. And that's how it differs from a lot of different approaches that we've tried before. And while, you do get occasional authoritarian sects forming within science, they generally don't last that long because at a certain point they fail the golden rule of science, which is show me the evidence. And show me the evidence is really a golden key to non-authoritarianism, because authoritarianism wants you to believe because I say so. It wants you to believe despite or without evidence, and that's made into a virtue. In the story of in the Bible of Doubting Thomas, the character of Jesus is made to give Thomas a bad time for asking for evidence. And it's kind of baked into religion not to want to ask evidence. That makes you ye of little faith. So they elevate faith, which is like, I guess, pretending to know what you don't know, above evidence and knowing and adjusting your what you know or think you know to the available evidence. So that the experiments, because I guess I'd always suspected this, but the experiments and the headless way approach really brings it to a point, because you're not told what the answer is. You're told to look for yourself. The only thing is, not everyone is. It's not the answer to the question that everyone's asking. I mean, you have to actually be interested and curious for that process to matter. So I can understand why this approach is not as popular as many others.
So that must have been a relief for you, a freedom.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it didn't happen while I was still in the cult. I'd left the cult and I'd got interested in other things and other teachers. And these teachers were less authoritarian than Rajneesh, but they all had an element of, I've got the answer and you haven't, even if it was tacit. Even the good ones had that. So there was always this sense of, like, have I really got it? And will someone tell me when I've got it? Which is weird when you think about it. It's very strange. But that was the feeling until I did the experiment, which was, for me, the first one was the pointing experiment, until I pointed here and saw the boundless nature of that, what I was looking out of. When it kind of saw itself, or however you say it, it was like it's not even a matter of doubt or certainty. I mean, doubt and certainty apply to things in the view out, things that you can see, phenomena. Those categories don't even apply here. So it is a tremendous, tremendous relief. It's like, and it is every time I notice it again too. Like just talking to you then, just noticing it then. It's a fantastic experience of decompression.
So this also has a implication in terms of one's relationship with others who are interested in this kind of thing. I'm assuming that when you were in the cult, you were all, in a way, agreeing that you hadn't got it, and you'd get a kind of competitiveness maybe arising out of that. But the situation in the headless community, if I can put it like that, is, well, I for one anyway accept that it's so simple, how could you not get it? That's not an issue. The issue is what's your response to this, rather than do you find that
it's really if you're not all trying to reach for the golden ring together, and if everyone's understood to already have it, it's a different conversation completely. It's a different relationship completely. if you're all relating to this enlightened guy, there's inevitably going to be competition. It's like one guy having many wives or a woman having many husbands. You know, whatever you say about it, there's going to be a sense of competition, a competition for attention from the and approval and you know, him telling you you're right or her telling you're right, that you've got it or you haven't got it. And that's going to be there under the surface the whole time. And also the sense that certainly in our particular cult, anybody who claimed to have got it was immediately ridiculed and basically sent to Coventry. You know, that was evidence of ego in everybody except the master, weirdly. And one way that you could get banned from the ashram, and I think it's still true, is by declaring that you're enlightened. I mean, this happened to a friend of mine who was sort of around the this is in the 2000s, someone who a teacher who came to a Gurukula like you did, and was a kind of a non-duality teacher, but she visited the ashram. I don't know if she took sannyas, but she was in there for a while. She knew some sannyasins, and she declared herself enlightened, and then she couldn't go there anymore. So there's a sense that amongst us, that's not even a question. Like, I assume that anyone who's done the experiments and values them is in the same condition.
And even if they haven't, it doesn't matter because they're looking, they can't see their own head. They're looking out of who they really
Sure,
are.
absolutely.
So it's not even a matter of whether you say yes or no, although that is hugely important. And, you know, obviously, we both of us say yes to it, and or we look again and say yes again, but we accept that it's true for everyone. So we're speaking from the same silence, if you like.
I think from the social, I was really talking about the social aspect of it. The social aspect inside a cult is you're all related and to the master more than you're related to each other. And there's a lot done to keep that in place. Like most cults just really discourage long-term relationships between people. They tend to break up couples and break up families and that kind of thing. And there's a reason for that. And that is that the master wants your undivided devotion. And that has an effect on the social milieu in which you are. Not only does it make you feel like you're all somehow lacking and therefore in some deep way untrustworthy. It's quite weird. The only one who is trustworthy is the master. Whereas amongst our friends, talking about this, there's no sense in which one of us is more headless than the others. I mean, it's a kind of ridiculous thought.
So I suppose, you know, in one way, that's a problem, isn't it? The way that that cult-like organization is structured. Do you think that the headless way is a kind, is an answer to that in, at some level, or what?
I certainly think a non-authoritarian approaches like this one have to be part of the answer. Yes. I think as long as you have that in that structure in place, the traditional structure of the teacher who's got it and the students who don't, and then a long period of the students trying to get it, it creates a kind of window opportunity for all kinds of bad stuff to happen. And it's not something that even teachers, I think most teachers are kind of sucked into the mechanics of it. In their book, Olsted and Kramer go the Guru Papers. They excellent book, by the way. They go into the mechanics of how that happens, and the way it happens almost mechanically. Well, it happens mechanically as a sort of social mechanism. When you have that attitude, it ends up putting a lot of power, a great deal of asymmetry of power, and the person who is in the teacher's role is very much surrounded by people who are agreeing with him and feeding back to him his own infallibility. The people around him are very much getting the reinforced that they haven't got it, the only way forward is behind the noble leader, you know, to stay in touch with him. And the worst punishment that they could think of would be thrust into the outer darkness, you know, to be taken out of his company. So that, and he's constantly getting fed by that. So even if you've got even a small kernel of potential narcissism, being in that situation is going to turn you into a monster. And we've seen it happen. I mean, even in our time, it's happened over and over again. Even with people who were probably quite sincere to begin with. I mean, there are a couple of instances where it was obviously a conscious charlatan. Someone like L. Ron Hubbard, who's founded Scientology, is pretty obviously a con man. But there are obviously people who, I'd say like Rajneesh, who in the beginning probably really sincerely was trying to do something useful for the world. But the mechanics of the situation turned him into a kind of, it turned him into an authoritarian cult leader who was really just exploiting everybody around him and justifying it in terms of his work. So everything was in terms of the work that he was doing, which was never really well defined to any of us. We just had to take it on faith that his work was the most important thing. And so as the weirdness built up, you know, the 93 Rolls Royces and the poisonings of the outside world to rig elections and all the guns and the weirdness, as it built up, he somehow made it okay in his head. I don't know how that this was all happening, but we did too. I mean, we all up to a point, and then people fell away at different stages, you know, and some are still rusted on. I'm sorry to say, but it got very, very strange. And it's not the only story like this. I mean, I've been very interested in other, like the Nexium cult, and there are a whole lot of them where a very, very similar trajectory is followed, even though the beliefs and the teachings and the style, all of that, and even the scale, all different, but the actual mechanism of this authoritarian disaster are the same. And it doesn't only occur in religion, it happens in society at large as well. I mean, you could say that America was taken over for 4 years by an authoritarian cult in the form of Donald Trump, not very well organized, but it had all of the aspects of authoritarianism. Everything that Trump said was okay, and he was the anointed one of God, and therefore you didn't have to think, you just had to go with what he said, even though he contradicted himself and told obvious lies continually the time he was there. And now we have Putin, of course, invading, you know, he's invaded another country on the basis of his own kind of cult-like dreams of an extended Russia. And, you know, so it's very dangerous, this authoritarian trap. And it got me thinking about how it relates to seeing and what seeing means to it, as you were saying.
Well, I was wondering if you turned the searchlight on the Headless Way insofar as it's a community or an organization or a way, would you see dangers there? Would you see anything of that? I mean, how would you respond to, well, Sam, you know, look at yourself.
Look, in its current form and in my experience, it's not authoritarian. But I think we need to remain alert for signs of that. And the minute the egalitarian peer-to-peer nature of it is lost or in peril, then we'll be on a slippery slope, I think. I think the likelihood of that is low because of the way people are brought into it. The way that people are brought into other cults is quite significant. They're usually brought in with some kind of conversion experience, which is very rah, rah, rah. It's got a lot of emotion around it. It's got a lot of love bombing. The person is, you know, usually made a big fuss of and brought in. And it's only after, and once they're in, and further demands are made upon them until they're fully, you know, they're fully stuck. They've invested so much in it that to pull out would be very difficult. Headless Way is not like that. It's like you get the goods, the entire goods, right at the beginning. So there's no question of come in here and get started on this. And after a few, you know, we'll initiate you through all these stages. And at a certain point, you know, you'll reach the goal. We don't do that. We just say, here it is. You know, here's the whole thing. And like within the first few minutes of a workshop, it's given as quickly as possible. I mean, obviously, the only impediment to doing it straight away is to give it some kind of framework that's meaningful to the people in the workshop. And that's a matter of individual judgment. But it's always given at the beginning. And there's this, it's always given with the knowledge that that's it, that there's no more to it. And that whatever comes after that, the meaning that you give to it even, is from you, not from the workshop facilitator. I mean, it's in your book, when gurus, in your article, When Gurus Become Friends, it really lays it out very clearly, the difference between this approach and others, and that diagram with the dots, you know, all connected to each other rather than connected through one single dot at the beginning, at the middle, like other sort of teacher-based cults. So that to me gives me some hope that we won't, or this approach won't be derailed into an authoritarian cult. And the other thing is, it doesn't make any demands on you. People can come and go as they like. And we're not kind of guilting people out if they've been away and they come back 10 years later. You know, there's not this sense of, like, if I have to miss a Zoom meeting or something, I don't feel terrible. I'll feel like, bummer, I missed the meeting, but, you know, I won't feel like I've done anything bad or that I'm going to be in trouble. And the thing that characterized my whole time in the cult was kind of low-level fear. Very interesting that I was pretty much afraid the whole time. This is something that most people in cults report. And the fear is of not getting it right, of doing something bad enough to be thrown out, or of being forced to do something so terrible because of your devotion to the leader. Because you see people doing things that you think are pretty bad, and you think, well, they're doing it because the leader said so. So that there, you know, that could happen to me too. So there's this constant tension between your own sort of inner moral compass and what you're being put through. And I don't experience that with headlessness. It makes no kind of demands on me like that. I mean, I voluntarily give my time to doing a few things, but it's not onerous. I enjoy it, and I experience it as a privilege. And I don't think if I stopped it, I would be any less headless. You know, it wouldn't actually reduce my immersion in the experience at all. It's just so. In answer to your question, I think it is turning the spotlight. Is you have to kind of be vigilant. I agree, but the things you've got to watch out for are anytime you're asked to accept truth claims of any type without evidence. And any time that authority is exercised without accountability. Any time that someone does something and you think, oh, he's done it, but there's nothing I can do about that. I can't challenge him for whatever reason. Those seem to be the two things in common with authoritarian cults. They make you believe, or at least profess belief in things that you don't know, and they don't give you any evidence for why they would be true, but you have to believe them. And the leader is not accountable. He's above reproach.
So in one way, there's nothing to learn, is there? You look, and you're not learning something when you see who you are. I mean, in some ways, I suppose you could say you are, but you're seeing freshly that you're built open for the world, and you are your own authority on that. But at a social level, there is a learning process, isn't there? And there's, it seems to me that amongst my friends that I share this with, there's a gradually growing understanding of the kind of things you've been saying, that everyone's got it, that everyone's response to it is valid. Those kinds of things are deeply different from the normal culture in a religious grouping, perhaps, or even in a political grouping. But this is about It's about your true identity. And I think we're all learning as we go along, really, how to handle this and how to relate to each other. I suppose for me, the saving grace is that it doesn't depend on the community. If everyone, you know, either left or started to say that bloke's got it and I don't, I'd say, well, I don't agree, but you know, in the end, who cares?
That's it. I mean, we if you see the point, if you really see it, if you see the setup, then the community is incredibly valuable, but it's not essential. I mean,
so why is the community valuable, do you think?
I think it's because we are very social creatures. Human beings at a human level are very, very social, as many other primates and mammals and birds are. You know, it's a living thing to want to hang out with members of your own species, and with human beings have a very rich experience of the world that's related to stories and narratives and trying to understand what's going on. And so to hang out with a bunch of people who are interested in the same things, and that's at any level, I mean, whether it's hang gliding or embroidery or, you know, is very rich. I mean, I belong to an electric car club because I've got an electric car and I'm interested in the subject. And, I mean, I'll hang out with those guys and talk about stuff that would turn everybody else's brain to mush, you know. But I dig it because I'm there with people who at the level of humanity, my humanity, finding other humans for whom this is valuable is just gold. On that, that's at the to start with. That's important. The other thing is that we're all each other's teachers. Then we become like this many-headed organism, this many-brained organism, all reflecting from the same space. And I hear myself when you talk as if I'm talking. And I'm sure it's true for you there too. So it vastly enriches the experience in a way that's almost incalculable.
It's infectious, isn't it? I mean, as soon as you say, put in other words, the two voices, our two voices are in one consciousness, it's all within me, then suddenly I'm aware that both voices are in one consciousness. And that is, you know, with the car club, you point something out and you're both aware of what the electric car does, you know. Well, it's not rocket science. It's not obscure. It is sharing in the same way, a realization or understanding, but it's mind blowing. I mean, it's not just about, cars or something. It's about, there is only one space here. There's only one consciousness, and everything is in it. And so if one is really deeply thrilled by that, how wonderful to meet others who are thrilled by it as well.
Yeah. And of course, any other interest you have in life is just a tiny sliver of life, you know, whether it's, even if it's very important to you. Whereas this contains the whole of life. And to have friends who can see that too and talk from that space and compare notes, tremendous.
So you share this with your wife. That must be, I imagine, an important ingredient in your relationship.
Look, it's a matter of great felicity, I got to tell you. I mean, it's hard to say. We do get on very well anyway, and we did before headlessness. But when we both became headless at roughly the same time, I think the same night, we both saw it. I think I took to it a little bit more rapidly than Mary did. But over time, it kind of became the default way of us being together. So you're with somebody who, for whom this is the natural way of being. And then when it's interrupted by, you know, being ambushed by negative feelings or an adverse situation, it's a great help for you can help the other one by holding the headless space. You don't have to say, oh no, you've got to be headless now. This is, we don't do that. We just, one holds the headless, one of us is usually holding the headless space while the other one's freaking out, and we take turns.
Well, I mean, just to jump in there, it's probably the worst thing you could say is, all right, Mary, you now be headless. You're not being headless.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that is...
That's infuriating. It's like, calm down.
Yeah, and it's against the spirit of it, isn't it? Because
of course it is. That would be me being authoritarian.
Yeah.
Saying, now you've got to be headless. You know, that's not like that. It doesn't work. But I had some other thoughts regarding this approach and authoritarianism. Have we got time to talk about those?
Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking about the face game and what a brilliant way of understanding human psychological development that is. And you introduced me to that on our first night together in doing the card experiment. And it really blew my mind almost as much as the experience itself. Actually, this way of understanding that Douglas worked out. Do you want to just briefly
No,
explain
you
what,
say it in your own words. What's your right. understanding? Yes.
Well, it divides the human experience roughly into four stages. There are versions of it that have different numbers, but I'm going to say the four versions. And it begins at birth. And it's all related to conscious first personhood. So it's not really understandable unless you're seeing from where you're seeing from. So it's good at this point to point back at where you're looking from and notice what you're seeing and actually do it physically. Take your finger and point back at where others see your face and look what you're pointing into. That's the basis for understanding the face game. So when you come into the world, what you're seeing when you point there is really all that is there. You are open space. You are space for the world. There's no context. There's no interpretation. There's no identification even. There's just the world experiencing itself without any kind of context. So that's a wonderful state. And little children give off this amazing, or babies particularly give off this incredible glow and are incredibly beautiful because of this. We recognize it even from in the third person. We recognize it as something very precious, and we always most normally, psychologically normal people want to look after babies. You know, if you come across a baby in the street, you will look after it and treasure it, and not just because it's a proto-human being, but because of this amazing state it's in. So, and there's a sense that there's something very sacred about that. And we have a kind of nostalgia, I think, about the golden period in our development. And I think that's what that is for. That's what that's about. But of course, a baby can't stay a baby and has to become a person. And in order to have autonomy, it has to have a map of itself, has to have a kind of self-concept, has to know how it fits into the world and all of that. And so the second stage of the face game is learning that the one in the mirror, the face in the mirror, is what others see where you are and that's what's really there. So you begin to, about 1 year to 18 months, little children recognize themselves in mirrors and realize the one they're looking at is the one they are. So the way that Douglas explained it very beautifully is that we, for the face game, we take that little face in the mirror and we pop it inside out so it's facing the other way. We stretch it out and we put it on here where our face is. It's like a mask. And interestingly, the word person comes from persona, which is the Greek word for mask. It's a something that you speak through, what you speak through. And that mask, you have to take seriously as being who you are. And as a little child, you start to do that. But you're still very flexible. So you can let go of the mask and become a lion or a train or a cloud at will, and then go back to it. So it's a very happy time when you're experimenting with being a person, but you've still got certain amount of freedom, and you haven't lost complete contact with your boundless wonderfulness. So that's stage two. Then we get to stage three, which is really, I'll call it adolescence into adulthood. It begins in adolescence, and it's a stage where you have to decide what person you're going to be. So by this time, the physical fact of your being the one you are in the mirror has taken on all this psychological baggage. So all of the things that you think about yourselves attach to this thing that you've become in the world. You've become a thing in the world. And you have all this stuff. And where are you going to put it? You're going to stick it inside that thing. So immediately you become a thing. You've got inside the thing and outside the thing. So you've got a barrier. You've got a kind of surface between what's inside you and what's outside you. And what's outside you is pretty scary. But what's inside you is even scarier. So you're in a pretty dire situation. And a lot, you know, you start to realize this as an adolescent. You realize that your options are closing down. You're kind of entering a kind of long funnel in which you're going to have to choose the furniture very carefully because you're going to be there for the rest of your life. You don't put it to yourself that way, but that's the sense that you're getting. And Pete, there's a lot of pressure on you to make very important decisions about what you're going to do, you know, what subjects you're going to study, what job you're going to have, all of that sort of thing. But you also have to figure out what kind of act you're going to have, what kind of person you're going to be, how you're going to present to the world. So your peer group becomes incredibly important to you. You've got to be, and you're very vulnerable to bullying at that point too, because if you're rejected by your peer group, it can be very, very damaging to your self-esteem and to your sense of yourself. So it's a terrible time, adolescence. And unsurprising, I mean, very sadly, quite a lot of people end their lives in that period because it's so horrible. But you make it through and you become an adult, and by this time you're pretty much welded to the one you look like. Pretty much become convinced you are a thing, and there might be something more to you than being a thing, but it's a bit mysterious and it's kind of lost and you don't know what it is. And there's definitely an outside and inside, and what's inside is a lot of it's very untrustworthy because it's stuff you don't want to know about. You know, it's stuff you've actually repressed in the process of becoming a thing. It's stuff you don't want people to know about. It's what you're afraid you might be like. And then there's what you present to the world. So you've got this kind of split between who you are afraid you are and what you would like to be and what you like people to think you are. So you're kind of in a bad way. And this is the human condition as experienced by most people. And we all go through it. And, you know, there are various cures for this that have been touted. And I guess all religions and spiritual approaches and psychology and all of that are all really ways of curing this condition, which we call normal adulthood, I guess. And then the fourth stage we get to is seeing. And this is when you recover the boundlessness by whatever means of your initial condition when you came into the world. But at the same time, you retain all of the skill set and the way of being in the world that you acquired by becoming, you know, by believing you're a thing. So there's this wonderful situation where you kind of realize that your thinging yourself wasn't a mistake. It was a stage in a process. So you can forgive yourself for this, what you went through. It wasn't a mistake. And so this is a very humane idea. I mean, I hadn't come across this idea in any other spiritual tradition that I looked into. All of them regarded the thinging yourself as a kind of egocentric mistake that you had to get rid of. You had to kind of dissolve it. But once you recover your original condition and you realize that you don't need to do anything about it, that you're okay as you are in a very, very deep sense. Now, of course, there's a process that continues after that where stuff comes up and the unconscious becomes conscious. All of that stuff that you've been going through keeps happening. But it's now happening not from you thinking there's something wrong with you. It's coming from you experiencing the setup as it really is and welcoming whatever comes up and being able to return at will to your original condition. So you don't even have to cling to it. You don't even have to get attached to your original condition again. You're even free of that. You're allowed to be who you are. You're allowed to forget. You're allowed to go astray, because you can come back instantly. This is real liberation to me. This is spontaneous liberation. This isn't kind of lying in a warm bath with headphones on, listening to Om. You know, this is full engagement with life, with all the danger and interest and creativity and thrill, but at the same time having this refuge from which you're living, which is boundless and impenetrable and not in time, you know, it's timeless. So that's the face game. So the fourth stage is, let's say it's an unqualified good thing. And it's not some esoteric, you know, rarely discovered condition. It's a normal stage of human development. In the face game, this is being a seer, as Douglas called it, is not anything special. It's just our birthright. It's who we, you know, it's just the culmination of a series of developments as human beings or sentient beings. So that's the face game, as I understand it. Does that comport with your understanding?
Yes.
Do you have anything to add to that that I've left out?
Well, I think that recognition that the one sense of self having its place, and it's as simple as when you look in the mirror, you see where your face is, and it's there and not here. And identifying with that face in the mirror doesn't create a face over here.
No.
You enjoy. I enjoy being Richard, you know, some of the time.
But, come on.
it's not a matter of getting rid, as you said so well, not a matter of purifying yourself or, you know, cleaning up your act or something in order to be who you really are. I mean, I've lived long enough with it to know, at least for me, that doesn't happen and is not going to happen. But that's okay, because that's Richard, and I have two sides to myself: the human, which is full of imperfections, if you like, and the space here, which is clean, clear, always available, never goes away. And I know that that's true in everyone. So. One is not only off the hook oneself, but you others are off the hook, I think, and they are, yeah.
So the way this relates in my thinking to authoritarianism is that this game, is the initial stages of it, have to be played in an authoritarian way. And by that I mean is you have to take things on trust and without evidence. And you have to give away your authority in order to be accepted into the human club. So children have to do things just because their parents say so. And it's important that we do. It's not a mistake. So there's an authoritarianism sort of baked into the face game, which I can't think of a way of avoiding. Maybe there is, but the way it's played, as I play it and as I've played it and the way I see it played, it's got this element in it that you give away your authority to others.
Well, you're accepting that you are what others say you are.
Yeah, you're accepting that. Yeah. You're accepting that. But you're accepting that in a way that excludes your own experience. And so you've kind of been gaslit by society in order to join society. So there's a cult-like aspect in society itself. It's kind of baked into the way we do being humans. So it's unsurprising. And the split that I talked about, of, you know, being the inner outer split that's caused by the face game and our sense of distrust of our inner world, makes us very, very prone to this lack of confidence in ourselves, to being to falling prey to an authoritarian influence. Someone saying, look, follow me, it'll all be okay. I'm the enlightened one. Don't rely on your own thinking. You know, your best thinking has got you to where you are now. You're in deep trouble. So just forget all that. Just follow me. It'll be okay. And that applies in lots of different areas of life. People are very prone to that. And I think that you remain prone to that until you see through that split. That's the idea that I had that I wanted to discuss with you. Because, you know, even if you get through, I've seen people get through one cult and then just get pulled into another one. They see through that cult, but the split is still there. Their underconfidence is still there. And so they immediately get, they sort of go to another one. They get pulled into another one. I've seen this in people who are in the Rajneesh cult with me, and others have described this process. So it's, I don't think it's unusual. And as long as people are split that way, we will always have, you know, vulnerability to the strong leader in politics. You know, your Mussolinis and your Hitlers and your Pol Pots and Stalins who make people feel secure by giving them something to believe in, because they don't believe in themselves. You know, they have no confidence in themselves. So it occurred to me that what we're doing in terms of, you know, celebrating and sharing this discovery, this fourth stage of the face game, is very important in as a way of mitigating authoritarianism in ourselves first, but in whoever it discovers this, I think becomes less less vulnerable. It doesn't mean that you have to discover this in order not to be vulnerable. There are other ways. I mean, a lot of people have seen through authoritarianism without discovering this. I'm not saying that, but I think it's a very important part. Some version of this, some way of overcoming this inner split, this inner distrust of ourselves has to be mastered before we can move on and you know, get out of the stage of our history where authoritarianism has been the only way of doing things.
Well, yes. The headless way, which gives direct access to your true nature without any conditions, that should get a few people worried, you know.
In the old days, it would have
wanted, but in essence, it comes down to oneself. Because for me, I can't even rely on the headless community.
No,
that is putting the authority again out there. It is a basic kind of rebelliousness. It's a basic kind of whatever you say. I am going to look for myself. I'm going to be my own authority. And if you want to hang out and you agree with that, great. And if you don't, so be it.
Yeah, exactly. I love that bit of graffiti. It said, someone wrote, "Be your own authority" on a wall, and someone underneath it wrote, "No."
Yes.
So what will be the, I mean, obviously there are certain structures in society that will require and continue to require authority. But the difference, I think I said earlier, the thing I realized about authoritarian power is that it's unaccountable. So when you have unaccountable power, power that doesn't have to account to anybody, then you've got authoritarianism. But if you've got, like if I go to a dentist, he's an authority. He tells me what I need to do about my teeth. But he's accountable for what he tells me. He gives me bad advice and my teeth are worse off for his treatment. I have recourse, you know, or I take it, my car to a mechanic. He's an authority with respect to my car. And people in government we appoint authorities to look after. I mean, if we had to take a, you know, democratic vote on every minute bit of minutia that we did as a society, the whole thing would just grind to a halt. And I've been in clubs, you know, if you want to get anything done, you appoint a small committee and then they report to the club on their findings. So the idea of authority is not bad in itself. It's a kind of superpower that humans have. This delegation of authority has got its place. But where it should never happen, especially, is delegating it to someone who's exercising it without any kind of accountability, and especially delegating it with respect to who we really are, to our true nature.
Yes, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, I think as soon as you start to think about it, you realize, well, no one is where I am. So no one has the authority to say what it's like where I am. And that's the whole point of the Headless Way is, who are you? What is it like right where you are? Well, people can share their point of view, but they have no authority, no authority. Yeah. As soon as you get that, I mean, in that moment, at least, game over. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is, it gets much richer as a kind of discourse too.
Mm.
Like I'm hearing what you're saying about it, and I'm not threatened by the idea that you might have a different view of it than me. Mm. I kind of hope you do.
Yeah. Yes, and we're friends. We're not members of a organization. There isn't a membership. Yeah. I'd like you to fill in this form and it's a tick box form. Are you headless? Do you move, or does the world move through you?
Yes. Like doing an exam on the way in. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? Then you get a little certificate at the end of that.
I think that, one has to work these things out for oneself. You know, what is sharing it? I'm not sure what sharing it is, but it's not showing you something because I can't.
Mm.
And you can't show me because you're not here. So to a certain level, I accept you're conscious. I mean, I've no direct evidence that you are even conscious. No. But I accept that. I got, go along with that. Accepting that, I then accept what you tell me, which makes sense, is that your consciousness is like mine. It's vast and open and full of the world, but it's full of a different angle on the world from what I'm experiencing. Well, we're accepting that it's the same at root for us, and so, and yet different in expression. So now the thing is, if you're interested, hang out with others and share your responses, because it's inspiring and interesting and all the rest. Yeah, this is not an authoritarian structure, I'm sure that someone looking at a group of headless people would say, oh, well, that person has got more power. So be it. That's all going to happen in society. That's the external thing, and it's limited. But internally, I'm not in the group. The group is in me. If you want to join the headless crowd, see that you can't.
Well, see that you're already in it.
Well, it's in you. That's right.
Yeah.
The best way to feel that you belong in the world is to see that the world belongs in you, and no one can stop you doing that. And
no, that's true. And no one can verify your experience for you.
No.
That's the other aspect of cults, is that the idea that of being reinforced in your beliefs by others around you believing the other things fervently as well. So there's all kinds of calls to seriousness and commitment to show that you're really devoted, or I don't see that in what we're doing. There are no there are no criteria for engagement here. You just have to be here. And
I have someone who trolls me, on YouTube.
Yeah.
Writes all kind, is a regular contributor. His main argument, often enough, is this does not line up with the scriptures. He picks holes in it with what I say in detail. 4 minutes and 30 seconds he said this. And then, interestingly enough, often at the end, he descends into a personal abuse.
Sure.
And you think, what's that about? You haven't got my attention enough yet, so you're going to see if you can, provoke me. It's weird. But what would you say? I mean, is this enlightenment? You're probably an authority on enlightenment, Sam. I'm just teasing you. But people would say, I remember Douglas Harding. He went with his son to the Buddhist Society Summer School at one point. I think before I met him, it was. And his son was became a Buddhist monk for a while and was interested. And of course, there's Douglas sharing enlightenment, mm-hmm. and mentioned to his son, you know, that Judy and I think it was three elderly women were now aware of their true nature. You see, well, we know what he means, but yeah. Julian said to his dad, he said, "Father, those three women are not having the same experience as the Sakyamuni Buddha." you know,
and he knows this because,
well, yes.
Exactly. But that's the thing about this approach is anathema to people who've been captured by authoritarianism. The fact that your troll references the scriptures is no surprise. He's going to be someone who's completely captured by an authoritarian belief system who sees this as a threat to it. And that's going to be normal. I mean, and I get people, you know, who I share this with who say the same thing. They say, "Oh, this is not enlightenment as described in this," or seeing's all very, you know, headlessness is all very well. But if you really want, you know, then you should check out this scripture. It doesn't fit with this.
Well, and this it'll be teacher, something.
Yeah, this teacher, that, and of course, the minute someone says that, you realize that they've actually got more investment in that particular belief system than they have in their own curiosity about the truth.
Well, there's not much. So. It's like they are saying that they know what it's all about.
Right.
I mean, they've got to know what it's all about to say that you haven't got it. You know, at least they know better than you. It's a minefield. You know, it's a.
It's interesting, though. I mean, I've been there myself in the my guru is more enlightened than your guru game. It's a very important game when you're playing it because your own self-esteem is kind of hooked up to that star. You know, I mean, if you're wearing the guy's picture on your beads and you've got your orange dress on and someone's dissing your master, you feel that as a personal attack. You're not going to brook that lightly. I mean, they've done fMRI scans of people, and when your belief system is attacked or your identity is attacked, your psychological identity is attacked, the same areas of your brain light up, same areas of the amygdala light up as if you were under physical attack. So, you know, it's like any strong identity forms its own defenses. And, you know,
well, I mean, on that subject, what do you think about that? Ongoing seeing who you are, you know, over years and years, as it were, does that affect your defensiveness or your brain patterns or, you know, God knows what? I mean, does it have a beneficial effect physiologically and all of that? What's your experience? What's your thought?
Look, it's very hard to make pronouncements on this subject because anything you say is pretty much unfalsifiable in the sense that I don't know how I would have been without seeing this, right? Mm. So, but with that out of the way, I would have to say that this relaxes me a lot about, I'm a lot less, I would say, defensive than I have been. And that may just be old age or whatever, but because I can see that I'm open, boundless, brightness, radiance, timeless being. Somehow the attack on the one I look like is less threatening. It's not completely unthreatening, and I will defend myself. I'll defend the one, you know, the one in the mirror will defend himself as is, you know, a human trait and quite lawful. But that's happening in the context of something that is doesn't need to be defended. So that I think that does change things. I mean, I've related that experience of being attacked verbally and potentially physically by a very lunatic client years ago. And what that experience was like really was an eye-opener for me. It was not long after I'd started seeing, and the ferocity of the attack affected my body in the sense that I had the kind of adrenaline fight or flight response that you'd expect. But there was also this added ingredient of kind of being able to take a backward step into the void and just experience it from there. And that was a very interesting experience because I was ready to act if I had to, but I was coming from a place of, it's very hard to describe, but that is what life is like for me now. So I can still be terrified by a deadline in my work or wake up worrying about things, but it's different. It's like those things don't seem to get as much traction. The wonderful teacher, philosopher, Zen guy, D.T. Suzuki, who had a Western wife who he loved very dearly, and she died, and he was very, very sad. And one of his friends asked him, so how's it going, D.T.? And he said, I'm very sad, but my sorrow has no roots. And it's okay. Like that. You can really experience your feelings to their true depths because they have no, because you go deeper than that. You go deeper than anything you can feel. And that's a huge liberation. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes. And you could phrase this whole discovery of who you really are as a new skill set.
I agree.
Yes, that when you move from the third stage to the fourth stage of seeing, when you are awake to your true nature, you have a tool, which you've just there illustrated how it can help in a difficult situation. It is a way of finding your way to relaxation, to see that you're not a thing, that everything is in you. It is the you kind of open up to the possibility that you are profoundly creative as your true nature, which, you know, the one in the mirror isn't. So that's going to open up your view of what is possible in your life, perhaps. I'd have thought so. And also in relationships, the experience of being face to no face, which is so easy to say, but the actual experience is a game changer. It's not face to face. You're built open. As you say, you can still defend yourself. You can, you know, no, I'm not going to give you my wallet, but you're within me. And it's a very loving thing. Now that, you know, I was talking to someone, well, you know him, he was in one of the Zoom groups. And after the pandemic, it was the first time he'd been out to a social gathering. He went to a wedding and he found himself chatting to people, but being space for them. Whereas before he would have felt anxious and wondering what, you know, where to stand and what to do and what to say, if he found himself just relaxed. And it was a really pleasant experience. And he could tell that people enjoyed being with him because he was relaxed. Now there's a skill set, isn't there, in a way? You know, you go apply this and find out that it works a lot better than not being aware of it. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. It's nobility, isn't it? It's what the word means to me. Nobility means to be in the world, but in some way to be unaffected by it at a deep level. In a way that you can engage then complete with freedom and creativity. And in chemistry, the noble gases are the ones that are not reactive.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. I think the lightest one is helium, but they have most atoms have either excess electrons or an electron hole in their outer shells. And so they react with other electrons, and it's like sodium and chlorine, for instance, react and become salt because of they've got places where they fit together. The noble the noble elements don't have any holes in their, you know, they don't have any deficiency. And to me, the seeing as I am, seeing myself as I am, is a sense of seeing where I'm not deficient. I'm obviously at the human level, I have many deficiencies and flaws, and you know, I'll always be a work in progress. But if I can operate from the place where I'm not deficient, that changes the game. That changes the way I come across. I don't want anything from anybody. That's real freedom. That's amazing.
And seeing who you are gives you access to that, doesn't it? And
Exactly.
I mean, who wouldn't want that? And who wouldn't want to taste that in their life, you know? But the problem is that people don't even know about it. And I think the work of the Headless Way is to get the message out and offer the skill set, and people can take it up if they want or not, you know. But I was given it freely, and it has made such a difference to my life and to many people I know.
Well, you've been responsible for infecting a large number of them, including me. Thanks very much.
it's an honor, an honor. Well, you go around making friends, you know. You go around making noble friends.
I mean, you say that people don't know about it. To the extent that they do know about it, it's often couched in terms that make it harder to see, though. And this is, I think, a part of our battle, is making it obvious that it's not something esoteric, hidden for the chosen few, the result of many lifetimes, you know, arduous work. It's actually there for you now. It's what is true about you now is the bullseye.
Well, you know, that is reflected in the way that I go about sharing, which is the way that I've been about sharing for years, but I had to learn it because I did it differently before. I used to give an introduction and give a context. And well, I mean, you after only a few minutes, you're into an argument. But
You've already
if and
engaged
you haven't even got to the point. So what I
somebody.
do, the yeah. So what I do these days, someone says, "So what is the headless way?" I've done it several times recently. I just look at them. I say, "Well, it's just noticing you can't see your face, your head now." And I move my hands into the headless space and back, and then we see, you know, you've lit the fuse. You see if there's interest or not, but you're engaged and you're
Gunpowder
looking. You know,
there.
that's straight to the point, you know,
No,
rather
I think that's
than
great. I think that it's being keeping your the mental aspect of it a small target. Because I mean, if people are very, you know, usually people got a whole suite of ideas about what this is, and they've usually got a bunch of investment in those ideas and sunk cost in a lot of that. So the less you say that's going to, you know, contradict any of that, the better.
Well, I think that might be a good point to end at least this part of the conversation.
I dare say that we'll be doing this for as long as we can still talk together, mate.
Yes, that's right. What did you say? It doesn't matter.
It's windy. No, it's Thursday. I agree. Let's go to the pub.
Okay, Sam, a pleasure to talk to you.
As always, my friend, stay healthy. Take care.